examining the damage from above. The beast had done a number on the twin hull, leaving deep rents in the stern and starboard rails. The command center had a broken windshield and a damaged radio.
"Michael better not come for us," X muttered to himself.
"Come again?" Magnolia said.
"Nothing."
X hadn't meant for her or Timothy to hear his thoughts about Katrina or Michael coming after him out here. He was terrified that the distress beacon Timothy had activated would provoke the captain into sending them help.
"I can do this on my own, with Miles's help, and maybe Mags's if she gets smart about shit."
Grabbing the metal rail, X went back to scanning the island. A few clicks to his wrist monitor brought up a map of their current location. They were in the West Indies, dead north of Hispaniola, which meant he was looking at a part of the Turks and Caicos island chain.
"Take us in, Mags," X said over the comlink.
"You sure about that?"
He grumbled. "You need to start trusting me, kid."
"And you need to stop calling me kid, although I won't hold my breath for that day." The single working engine purred beneath the deck, and the rudders turned slightly. He felt a little guilty about having yelled at her in the command center, but she had to understand. He didn't want Deliverance risking their hides for him. This was his decision. His mission. He wanted El Pulpo's head on a pike, and he wasn't going to stop until he found the bastard, and with any luck, discovered humankind's future home in the process. He wedged his boot between the metal ribs of the crow's nest and trained his rifle scope on the shore as the seawolf began cutting through the shallows. Lightning forked over the mountains, spreading a blue glow across the jagged cliffs and the mutated jungles surviving in near darkness. This was the third island they had come across in the past few hours, but the first showing any sign of civilization. X was hoping to find the tools to help repair their radio and fix the seawolf. His vantage point gave him a panoramic view of their surroundings, and he continued to scan the ocean, beach, and city beyond for contacts. He didn't need to activate his night vision goggles to see the island in detail. The sky retained a blue tint from the constant flashes across the mountain chain, casting an eerie glow on the terrain and the surf. Several large vessels stood aground on the shallow bottom, the waves beating their rusted hulls. On shore, a dozen shipping containers sat in the sand. X recognized the language marking the side. It was all in Spanish, the language of the Cazadores. Shadows flickered beneath the clouds. He zoomed in with his scope on what looked like missiles firing from the sky toward the jungles. At first, he passed them off as some trick of the light. But then he realized this was no optical illusion. His heart skipped at the realization. They had to be sirens. But when he zoomed in further and followed one of them in his sights, he saw these weren't the genetically modified humans at all. These were massive birds.
"I got potential hostiles," X said.
"I see him. Do you want me to change course?" X watched the beasts for several seconds. There were a dozen of them, and several were headed out to sea. From this distance, he wasn't sure how large they were, but they were big. They weren't just big, they were monsters. An ethereal wail made him flinch. He ducked down just as one of the creatures swooped overhead from behind, giving him a close-up glimpse. This one had a bald head the color of blood, and a wingspan longer than two men. The yellow beak was big enough to swallow a child. It flapped black wings, heading toward the shoreline with an eyeless fish clutched in its talons. A flashing antenna hung from the skull of the fish, blinking and giving the bird's underside a purple glow as it flew back to its nest on the island. These weren't birds. They were vultures. X checked his six for more of the flying beasts, but the sky was clear in that direction. He ignored the water until he saw something cresting the waves back in the bay. A spiky dorsal fin broke through the water, cutting the waves. The birds weren't the only hunters prowling these waters.
"Great," he muttered, flipping his NVGs on.
In the green hue, he saw the silhouette of a shark half the boat's length, just below the surface. The predators had survived nearly half a billion years on Earth. It should have been no surprise that they made it through the apocalypse.
"Mags, better pick up speed," X said into the comm.
"It's pretty shallow in here. I have to..." The crunch of the hull hitting something massive nearly sent X tumbling out of the crow's nest. He looked over the side of the cage at more silhouettes beneath the surface, but these weren't giant sharks or cephalopods. A graveyard of boats lay in the shallows, their carcasses strewn over the bottom where they had sunk at their moorings hundreds of years ago. They no doubt made perfect homes for all sorts of monsters.
"Hurry it up, Mags," he shouted.
The Seawolf clipped the stern of an ancient vessel just below the water, shaking X inside his aerial cage. He watched in horror as they plowed toward the minefield of sunken wrecks.
"I can't see," Magnolia shouted over the channel.
Miles barked in the background. The poor dog wasn't used to the confines of a boat any more than X was. He was meant to be free, to be able to run on the surface. But like humans, Miles had been dealt a cruel hand. The anger flowed through X as he tried to form a plan to get them out of this mess. There was always a way out. Always an option.
"I'll be your eyes, Max. Just calm down," X said. "Now turn a hair to the right. Now!"
The boat veered around a barnacle-encrusted wreck. Beyond it, several more derelict hulls broke the surface. Radio towers protruded from them like twisted rebar. The sight gave him an idea, but he tabled it for now and checked the status of the shark. Still trailing them, the sea monster lazily whipped its tail back and forth, moving through the water with ease. The perfect predator. X aimed his rifle and prepared to fire, then decided that the noise might attract more hungry things. The creature swerved away, sinking beneath the waves and vanishing into the boneyard of ships. X slowly lowered his rifle. It would be back. The Seawolf moved into the center of the bay at a good clip. At the helm, Magnolia steered around the clearly visible obstructions, and X continued to warn her of those buried beneath the dark surface. Piercing chirps from the birds hunting over the land filled the night. At least, X thought it was night. It was hard to tell in perpetual darkness. Day or night, his biological clock and his growling stomach told him it was time for supper. He fought both the pain radiating up his arm and the grip of exhaustion.
"Screw off," X muttered, raising his weapon and firing at a bird that swooped toward the boat.
The rounds lanced through its red-plumed wings, sending the creature arcing down toward the bay. Magnolia steered to port, avoiding the broken hull of a fishing vessel that had split in half on a submerged rock. Hearing a splash off the starboard side, X turned to see the bird he had shot flailing in the water. In a blink, the shark hunting in the shallows emerged, opened a mouth rimmed with two rows of teeth, and swallowed the struggling bird in a single bite. The sea beast vanished beneath the waves.
"Almost there, Mags," X said, trying to focus on the beach.
Their vessel squeezed through a gap between two ships aground in the tide. X got a view of their decks, still laden with shipping containers marked in the Cazadores' language. This wasn't the Metal Islands, but they had to be getting close. The starboard hull of the Seawolf screeched against the hull of the ship on the right. X kept his rifle up, roving for contacts on the decks to either side. A moment later, and they were free and sailing right for the shore.
"Beach us," X ordered.
Timothy, who had been silent until now, spoke up.
"Sir, I would highly recommend avoiding contact with solid land. The impact could damp..."
"Mags, shut our AI friend off, please," X said.
"Sorry, Timothy," Magnolia said. "Nothing personal."
The shark's dorsal fin surfaced again, and X wasted no time lining up the crosshairs on the head and pulling the trigger. The rounds punched into the dark skin around the open mouth, which yawed open to reveal feathers still stuck in the double rows of teeth. Blood trickled out of the bullet wounds, and the beast veered away, its tail slapping the starboard hull before it swam off into the bay. The impact knocked the Seawolf to the side so that the port hull caught the next swell of surf. Escapes like this were never based on pure logic, and sometimes, with just seconds to make a decision, a good option didn't present itself. This time, the only option was to hang on for his life. He clung to the cage as Magnolia tried to get the bow pointed ashore, but the surf was too strong. The waves slammed them broadside onto the beach where they skidded until they fetched up against a rock. X slid out of the crow's nest, losing his rifle in the process. His left boot caught on the rail, leaving him hanging upside down 20-odd feet above the sand. Dangling there,
He would be easy pickings for one of the oversized vultures, and dropping to the sand would leave him with broken legs, or worse.
X! Magnolia shouted.
She emerged on the deck below with Miles, who barked up at him. It took only a second to see that the dog was actually barking at three birds swooping in from the sky. X suddenly got a crazy idea. He swung his body until his boot dislodged, and using the momentum, he reached for the rungs. He fell several feet before finally catching one. Somehow, the force did not dislocate his shoulder, though pain lanced up his shoulder and neck. Wasting no time, he put his boots against the mast, clear of the rungs, and slid down until he could safely swing off onto the sand. Magnolia, with a rifle in each hand, and Miles were waiting for him there. She tossed X the rifle he had dropped, and they stood together back to back, firing on the swooping birds. They emptied their magazines, plucking a dozen from the sky with calculated shots to conserve precious ammo. The meaty bodies whacked into the sand 100 feet away, twitching and squawking as they died. X looked back over his shoulder to see whether the shark was still hunting in the surf. The seawolf had pushed up a berm of sand on the port side, and smoke continued to drift from the deck.
"You still don't think we need any help?" Magnolia asked while changing magazines.
The pot shot got under X's skin, and he couldn't hold back his words.
"Remember the Helldiver motto?"
"We dive so humanity survives."
X dipped his helmet and gestured for Miles to join him.
"This mission isn't about destroying humanity. It's about saving it. We dived for humanity. Now we're sailing for humanity. And I'm not going to risk deliverance or the hive just to save our sorry asses. We're on our own out here. And the sooner you start accepting that, the safer humanity is gonna be."
The men and women inside the launch bay of the hive were a diverse group. Les could see many shades of skin standing in front of the tubes that for centuries had launched Helldivers onto the post-apocalyptic world. But there was one thing these people all had in common. Youth. Les hated seeing so many young volunteers standing in a room that most people stepped into only a handful of times. Seeing his son among them was especially painful.
"Trey will have to make his own way," Captain DeVita's words repeated over and over in his mind as he looked over his son and the other volunteers.
Trey stood between Sandy Bloomberg, the daughter of the head farmer on the hive, and Jed Snow, an orphan that had lost his dad to diving and his mom to cancer. They were just months shy of their 18th birthdays, and it showed. Jed sported a thin beard that didn't quite cover all of his pimples, and had his long dark hair slicked back. Sandy tried to make herself look older by liberally applying homemade makeup, but it only served to emphasize her lack of experience with the stuff. She directed light blue eyes at Les and smiled, two crooked front teeth showing. The veterans, Commander Michael Everhart and Layla Brower, weren't much older than Jed, Sandy, and Trey. Only Aaron Jenkins was in her mid-20s. Vish Abaya and his twin brother Jaideep were also young, only 19 years old. They were both handsome, tall and dark-skinned, but they had spent the past few years in and out of trouble. They came from a Buddhist family that still practiced traditions of the old world, but the boys didn't shave their heads, wear robes, or meditate multiple times a day. Or at all. Ordinary brown jumpsuits draped their skinny frames, and gold hoops hung from their ears. Like many youth, the boys had rebelled, not because they were evil at heart, but because they were bored. Helldiving seemed to attract kids like this, until they realized what it really entailed, or until they died, whichever came first. Les had seen it plenty of times before, and he wasn't sure how to feel about their presence. Both Abaya twins were failed students and had spent most of their teenage years working odd jobs or in maintenance. Their last name meant fearless, but he wasn't sure they were cut out for the world of diving into the apocalypse.
"You sure about this?"
Vish whispered to his brother. Jaideep punched him on the arm.
"I told you to keep your trap shut."
"Jeez, man." Vish gave his brother a cockeyed look and rubbed his shoulder.
"What you looking at, old man?"
Jaideep asked Les. Vish laughed.
"You sure you're not too old to dive?"
"And too tall?" Jaideep added with a chuckle.
"That's Lieutenant Mitchell's to you," Trey said.
He took a step toward the twins, but Les shook his head.
The last thing he wanted to deal with right now was a fight that could end in Trey heading back to the brig.
Yeah, I'm tall, and I'm old enough to be your father. But if you're serious about diving, you both better get serious, because diving isn't a joke, Les said.
Jaideep smirked, but Vish nodded, apparently getting the message. The twins weren't the only potentially problematic divers. Erin Jenkins had a chip on her shoulder. Her mohawk glistened with paste under the overhead lights. She wore a sleeveless shirt that showed off her ropey, defined arm muscles. Michael and Layla were discussing something with her in private.
"We have no choice," Michael said loud enough for everyone to hear.
Layla put a hand on his arm, a subtle gesture to calm the commander down. Les had seen her do it 100 times, but this time it didn't seem to have any effect. Michael stalked over to the porthole windows to look out at the swirling storm clouds. For the past 2 months, both he and Erin had developed anger problems. Erin's was related to losing her dad, but Les wasn't sure where Michael's was coming from, unless it had something to do with X. Layla walked over to join Michael, and Les moved closer to Erin.
"Everything okay?" he asked.
Erin shrugged a shoulder. Les liked the young woman, but he wasn't sure he liked the idea of diving with her again until she got her emotions in hand. A prickly attitude could lead to poor decision-making, and a single poor decision could kill someone. For Les, with Trey standing just a few feet away, more was at stake now than ever before. Les had to protect his son at all costs, but he wasn't sure there would be a way to prevent Trey from diving with Erin in the coming months. The problem was simple math. They didn't have a very big pool of people to recruit from. The passengers were getting stronger thanks to an increase in food production, but the only volunteers so far were those now standing inside the launch bay. Katrina had privately communicated orders to Les, Michael, and Layla. She didn't want any of them diving unless absolutely necessary. Their focus was to be on the airships, not the surface. X and Mags were in charge of the ground for now. The metal doors screeched open, and everyone came to attention as Katrina finally walked into the room. She wore her braided hair over her shoulders, and her crisp white uniform pulled up over her forearms to proudly show off the raptor and angel tattoos.
"Good evening, Captain," Les said.
"Evening, Lieutenant."
Katrina stopped in front of the group, who gathered in a loose rank before her. She spent a moment taking them in, and Les did the same. Jed, Trey, and Sandy stood stiffly and respectfully, eyes forward like soldiers. Jaideep and Vish were more relaxed, and Jaideep seemed to be whistling a tune under his breath. Les realized if you added up all their ages, it still wouldn't equal the amount of dives Xavier Rodriguez had completed over the years.
"Welcome, and thank you, all of you, for volunteering," Katrina said. "I started diving when I was about your age."
Moving down the line, she looked at each of them in turn, stopping to give Jaideep and Vish another once-over. Then she moved on to Trey and Sandy. Finally, she walked past Erin, Layla, Michael, and Jed.
"Jed, I'm happy to see you here. Your dad would be extremely proud.
And your mom would be too," Katrina said.
"I'm proud to be here," Jed said. "If it weren't for some health problems, I would have been here when I turned 16.
Katrina forced a smile and then looked at Les.
"Lieutenant, may I have a word?"
She gestured toward Michael and Layla.
"You too, Commander Everhart and Diver Brower."
The three followed the captain over to the conference room, where hundreds of hell divers had received briefings over the years. Les saw Sandy's curious gaze follow them across the room before Katrina closed the door behind them.
"This is not enough," she said.
Michael and Les exchanged a glance.
"These are the only volunteers," Les said.
"We will need more."
Michael stepped forward, his back stiff.
"I thought we didn't have any upcoming missions."
Les was equally baffled. Did she have something planned that he didn't know about? Just last night she had told him there wouldn't be any dives for months. He wanted to ask what had changed in the past 24 hours, but his job as her right-hand man wasn't to question her in front of others. He would do that in private, unless she told them first. Katrina took a seat in her chair and put her hands on her head.
"Ma'am," Layla said, walking over to pat Katrina's back in a sign of support.
Les didn't know what to do. He hadn't seen Katrina like this since she first took the helm. But the trauma of losing her child, killing her former lover, and seeing X leave, again, and the burdens of being captain had likely stacked up.
She was a strong woman, but in the end she was only human. Katrina pulled her hands away from her flushed cheeks and stood again.
Sorry, I'm fine. There's just a lot on my mind, and I'm worried about our friends on the Seawolf.
X is still out there, Michael said.
I can feel it in my bones.
He's definitely a hard man to kill, but he isn't immortal, Katrina sighed.
I should never have sent him out there alone with Magnolia. We should have sent more boats, more...
After a pause, she looked to Les.
Lieutenant, I want you to meet with Sergeant Sloan as soon as possible. Tell her I need the best militia soldiers she can spare.
Michael raised a hand.
Captain, I thought I was in charge of finding new divers.
Things just changed, Commander,
Katrina replied, still looking at Les.
I need you for something else.
He had finally figured out what had her so bothered. She wasn't looking just for people who could dive. She wanted people who could fight. 4.
I feel like I haven't spent any real time with you in weeks, Din,
Layla said as they walked down the passageway connecting the Hive to Deliverance. News of the Seawolf had rattled him, but he couldn't do anything about it right now.
They need you here, X had told him before leaving. If something happens, don't come after me.
Maybe so, but Michael was having a hard time sitting idly by while X, Mags, and Miles were potentially in trouble. To do nothing felt like abandoning them. He knew that Layla was upset too, though she wasn't showing it.
Have you missed me? She asked.
He squeezed her hand.
Of course. I always miss you. Great answer.
Her smile still had the same effect on him as when they were kids. The cute dimple and gleaming white teeth still sent a little shiver through him.
I don't know what to do about X and Magnolia, he said.
Her grin vanished, and her hand went slack.
Don't do that, Michael said, taking her hand again. I know you're upset, too, and I think we should talk about this. Why talk about something we can't control? We can't go searching for them in those storms, you know that.
Yeah, but
you can't beat yourself up over this. Magnolia and X made their choice when they set off for the Metal Islands. They knew the risks, and besides, you said it best back in the launch bay. X might be in trouble, but he isn't dead.
Michael looked at the team raptor patch sewn over his chest. Inside his vest pocket were the words he had given X over a decade ago. Accept your past without regrets. Handle your present with confidence. Face your future without fear. He carried the quote with him even though he had it memorized. He had lived his life by the motto, and handing the quote to people was his way of giving back. Each time he gave it to someone, he wrote it down again for the next person.
Everything's going to be okay, Tin, Layla said.
Michael kissed her softly on the cheek.
I know. Come on. I have a surprise for you.
Her smile returned, and she followed him down the empty passage. Around the next corner, two technicians were installing a monitor inside the relocated engineering school. Places like this gave him hope. This was where they would train the next generation of engineers, the men and women who would help keep both ships in the sky. Many of them would also become helldivers. The cog continued to turn, spitting out the innocent youth aboard the airship. Young men and women like Jed Snow and Sandy Bloomberg, who were still just kids in Michael's eyes. He could still remember Jed and his mom in the trading post that day Layla and Michael had given him a fortune cookie. He memorized it a long time ago. Accept your past without regrets. Handle your present with confidence. Face your future without fear. Michael and Layla walked past several kids drawing on the bulkhead, and he wondered if they, too, would end up in the cog someday. Fresh paint glistened in the light. There were 4 kids, all about 8 to 10 years old. One of them was Phil, Les Mitchell's daughter. She reminded Michael of Layla at that age. Innocent, fun, aggressive.
That drawing stinks, midget, Paul said to his friend Jimmy Moffat. You should just give up already.
Michael shook his head.
Hey there.
But Layla beat him to the punch.
Paul, you apologize right now. I happen to think Jimmy's drawing is really good.
The short boy turned away from the bulkhead where he had painted a stick figure of some sort of animal.
Yeah? What is it then? Paul asked.
Layla stuttered.
It's art.
That's what matters, and name-calling is just going to get you into trouble.
Paul lowered his paintbrush, looked at Jimmy, and said,
Sorry. Your drawing doesn't suck.
And, Layla said, hands on her hips,
You're not a midget.
There, that's better, she replied. Now have fun, and don't get that paint all over the place. She left Michael standing there with the kids. He cracked a half-grin at Jimmy, and then hurried to catch up with Layla.
That totally reminded me of something from when we were kids, he said. Remember the time we were standing outside the school and Pipe was teasing me about my tin hat? That happened a lot. I'm talking about the time you did something about it.
Layla blushed.
Oh, yeah. I kicked him in the balls. I believe you called them marbles.
They both laughed as they walked on through the ship.
Pipe was a good man, Layla said. A bit of a dick when he was younger, but I miss his jokes. And me too. And Roger, and Ty, and Weaver, and...
Michael let the words trail off.
But enough about the past. Let's focus on the present, and how lucky we are.
Deal. She gave him a sly grin.
So where are you taking me?
I told you, it's a surprise. They passed several technicians and engineers in yellow coveralls, readying quarters for more lower deckers from the hive. Michael and Layla had kept their quarters there. Deliverance had saved their lives, but the hive would always be his home, until they found a place on the surface. The thought reminded him yet again of X, Magnolia, and Miles. They were down there somewhere in danger, while he took his girlfriend on a date. As if sensing his thoughts, Layla took his hand again.
Just you and me right now, remember? She said.
Right. Leaving the construction site behind, they turned into a passage already occupied by new passengers. Several hatches were propped open, providing glimpses into the lives of people who had lived below decks on the hive for most of their lives. Chloe and Daniel sat in a bunk in the room to his left. Both kids wore fresh bandages on their hands and over their heads.
I'll be right back, Michael said.
Layla waited for him as he knocked on the hatch.
Where are your parents? He asked the kids.
They both gave him a nervous look.
It's okay, I'm not going to get us in trouble or anything, Michael said.
He pulled two pieces of candy from his vest pocket.
Here you go. You're a hell diver, aren't you?
Daniel asked.
I am. What happened to that old guy?
Old guy?
Rick,
Chloe said.
That's what Jenga called him. He gave us candy jam.
Michael felt Layla's presence behind him.
He's gone, Layla replied. He died so we could have this new home.
Chloe looked at the ground and then overhead, chomping noisily on the hard candy. She and David were just two of the many kids who had deformities from the radiation poisoning.
Will you come back sometime?
Chloe asked. Michael smiled.
You betcha.
He waved, and they continued down the next passage. Neither spoke at first. They had grown up privileged, the child of a helldiver or of parents who worked in the brig. Seeing how these kids lived made his heart hurt. But at least they had a future now, for the first time in their lives.
Here we are.
Michael stopped outside the armory where two militia guards stood sentry.
Commander Everhart, said O'Toole,
a fit-looking man with a crossbow cradled across his chest armor.
We weren't expecting visitors, said Monk, the other sentry.
Well, that makes three of us, Layla replied, looking at Michael.
We're just checking something out, Michael said.
O'Toole punched an access code, and the double doors unlatched. He nodded at Monk, who stepped back. It still felt odd to Michael that men twice his age held him in such high regard, especially after thinking him a traitor just 2 months ago. But after capturing Deliverance and helping overthrow Captain Jordan, he was now one of the most respected men on the ship, second only to X, who was legend. Empty darkness greeted Michael and Layla as they stepped inside.
Lights, Michael said.
The voice-activated overheads clicked on, spreading a cool blue glow over metal bulkheads that flickered like water.
You brought me on a date to the armory? How romantic, Layla quipped. You really know how to get a girl out of her jumpsuit.
We're not here to look at weapons of mass destruction. This way.
They walked past six glass-covered bomb tubes. This was the equivalent of the launch bay on the Hive, but with nuclear bombs. Loaded, primed, and ready to drop.
Katrina should just dump this arsenal in the ocean, Layla said. Bury it in the dark, cold depths. I couldn't agree more.
Layla followed Michael to the pair of sealed hatches across the room. He pulled a key card out of his vest as they approached. A warning sign with a symbol for explosives hung from the bulkhead to the right. Layla halted outside the hatch. On the other side were assault rifles, missile launchers, grenades, and just about every other type of weapon humans had used to kill each other in the past.
"This is decidedly not romantic," she huffed.
Michael grinned.
"You don't trust me enough."
Using his key card, he swiped the button for the hatch on the left. It opened onto a staircase that spiraled down into the guts of the airship. Layla stepped to the side for a better look, then frowned.
"You are full of surprises, Tin."
He laughed and led the way down to a command room just big enough for two leather chairs and a console mounted with various instruments and screens.
"What is this place?" she asked.
"Combat Direction Center, or CDC, also called the Launch Operations Center."
"Excuse me?" Layla said, folding her arms across her chest.
"Relax. We're not launching any missiles or dropping any bombs."
Michael sat in front of the controls and flipped on the central main monitor. He used his keycard to access the mainframe, then pushed a button to open a metal hatch covering a rectangular glass screen that looked like a mirror. In the reflection, Layla remained standing behind him with arms crossed, looking at once stern and a little confused. The hatch opened to darkness. In the bowl of swirling black, a flash of lightning looked like branching blood vessels. The light faded away, leaving them with only the weak lighting from the main screen. Michael typed at a keyboard, entering his credentials a second time. A robotic voice came over the speakers.
"System online."
Layla put a hand on Michael's back.
"Okay. You're starting to freak me out a little. What are we doing here?"
"You're about to find out."
He tapped the keyboard, scrolling through historical records. Twisting around in his seat, he said,
"Timothy found an old world video in the archives and thought you might be interested."
"We're here to watch a video of the past?" she asked. "I thought we were focusing on the present."
Michael sighed.
"Yeah, I know I said that, but you've been spending a lot of time at the library working to restore the archives, and I think you might find something here."
Layla finally sat beside him, intrigued and annoyed, judging by her body language.
"You think there might be something new here? Something that isn't in the archives upstairs?"
"Timothy sure seems to think so," Michael said. "He asked me what you were looking for, and I said, 'Oh, nothing much, just a history of the world and humanity.' So he told me to come down here. He said we'd find information we had never seen in the archives, and it would help restore the history we lost."
Layla's hands squeezed his shoulders.
"So have you watched it yet?"
"Nope. Wanted to wait for you."
Michael started to hit play, but Layla touched his arm.
"That's really sweet, but don't you think we should tell Katrina, or maybe Les?"
"Why?"
"If this information is new, then maybe Katrina should see it first."
Michael pulled his hand back from the monitor.
"Far as I know, this is just a history video, like those we watched back in school. But if there's information on a hidden paradise that humans colonized, I'm happy to share it right away."
"Okay. Deal."
Layla looked at the screen.
"Let's get to it, then."
Michael grinned and hit the play button. The screen jittered, and the video started in an old-world metropolis. The streets between scrapers were packed with thousands of people. The sun, high in the sky, spread warm gold over cheering crowds, hands in the air, whistles blowing, confetti raining from buildings. A deep baritone voice spoke.
"In the year 2035, people took to the streets in every major city across the world, rejoicing in an agreement that brought all governments and all races closer together with a single currency and a shared economy. Business worldwide was booming with the creation of artificial intelligence and the solution to problems that had plagued humankind for centuries. A shared commitment between governments tackled the one thing that threatened peace: the energy crisis.
The video zoomed in on people from all countries and walks of life, every ethnicity, religion, and nationality. This was humanity. This was how the world once looked. But there was something he didn't recognize among these people. Machines strode around with their human handlers. Some were humanoid in appearance, but others were contraptions like the robot vacuum he had taken apart as a kid in the days following his father's death when X was looking after him.
"Are those what I think they are?"
Layla whispered. "AIs, like Timothy, only machines instead of a hologram." The video feed moved from city to city, all of them showing robots and humans in the streets, joined in celebration.
Industrial Tech Corporation, the most powerful company in the world, led the charge to combat the energy crisis and rising temperatures across the globe, said the narrator. An image tagged Chicago, Illinois came on screen, featuring the ITC symbol and headquarters building.
Hades, Michael said.
He would never forget the place that claimed the lives of everyone on the Hive's sister ship Ares. But the city looked far different from the wasteland X and the other divers had seen 10 years ago.
ITC had built facilities in hundreds of locations all across the world, the narrator continued. Images flashed of headquarters in Dubai, Shanghai, Sydney, Mexico City. Food production was more efficient than ever, and hunger, even in developing countries, had been all but eradicated.
Next came the images of robots driving massive machines, harvesting vast tracts of cropland that stretched to the horizon. Images of a laboratory came on screen. Men and women wearing white suits with helmets and breathing apparatuses worked in sterile environments.
Medical advances continued throughout the world, including cures for cancer and rare genetic diseases. The average life expectancy jumped to 105, thanks primarily to the work of ITC scientists. Tissues, limbs, and organs, even brains, were now being grown inside labs. The video went inside a hospital room where a baby born without limbs cried on a table. The parents stood by with tear-streaked faces. Next came an image of the same parents smiling over a bed where their child happily flailed its perfect little arms and legs.
"Amazing," Michael said, thinking of Chloe and Daniel.
"Some of this stuff I've seen before, but not like this," Layla said. "I didn't realize science had advanced so far before the world ended, or that ITC was behind so much of it."
"It doesn't surprise me," Michael said. "What we still don't know is what ended it all."
Lightning flashed outside, and he pushed a button to seal the hatch and block out the distracting sporadic light.
Despite medical and scientific breakthroughs, the narrator continued, the energy crisis threatened to reverse the advances in food production. Overpopulation, pollution, and depletion of fossil fuels led to the threat of war. The video showed an aerial view of a desert, but as the camera zoomed in, Michael saw that it was really a farm field, its crops shriveled and the dirt cracked. Dry gullies ran through the terrain, and barns were packed with ranks of idle robots.
Rising temperatures and drought quickly destroyed the achievements that scientists had made in the past decade. In the year 2041, humanity was once again spiraling toward war over dwindling resources.
This time, the video came from inside the Senate chamber in the United States. Michael recognized the seal and the podium from history classes.
Today, both parties have come together to tackle the issues of climate change and the drought afflicting the southern states, said a florid-faced senator with a flag pin on his lapel.
The audience stood, clapping. The narrator continued in the background.
Once again, governments and scientists around the world banded together, led by ITC. Within 2 years, they found an economical way to harvest water from the ocean by desalination.
The video returned to the cracked fields, and in a fast-moving time-lapse, the feed showed the checkered acres transforming into lush green Edens, with robot farmers harvesting bountiful crops.
In 2043, humanity was closer than ever before to solving all the problems that had led to war over the millennia. There was no need to fight over resources or territories. For the first time in 1,000 years, peace reigned in the Middle East.
Sometimes I don't believe this world was ever real, Layla said.
What doesn't seem real is that humans could have destroyed such a paradise.
Layla brought her knees up to her chest and watched as the video continued, but Michael's eyes left the screen and turned to his lifelong best friend. He moved over to her side, kissing her cheek, then her neck. Layla giggled and smiled the smile he had fallen for so many years ago. Their lips connected, and a moment later they were pulling each other's clothes off. His shirt caught around his head, and when he finally freed it, she was standing before him naked. She pushed him back into the chair. And for the next half hour, they ignored the video and made love in the cramped command center, their bodies sliding against each other, mouths pressed together in an act that would continue until the last humans perished. And for that brief, ecstatic interlude, Michael forgot everything that was wrong with life in the sky and the horrors on the surface. Nature had reclaimed the derelict city. Vines stretched across the sagging, broken streets and consumed the structures. Most of the buildings were debris piles, having collapsed long ago under the sheer weight of the vegetation. On a rocky bluff east of the city stood a single building, its 10 stories still firmly supported by sturdy concrete pillars. Tenants had once lounged on its balconies, drinking cocktails and watching the surf lap against the beach. Lonely toppled statues of mermaids and satyrs littered the courtyards around swimming pools, their hands and panpipes pointing at the dark, putrescent water. Magnolia pulled one of the 2 double-edged sickle blades sheathed on her lower back and sliced through a red plant growing on her path. Goo sluiced out onto the dirt.
"Careful with those," X said.
He was just ahead with Miles behind him, sniffing the air. She wasn't sure what X had planned. But she wasn't about to ask him now. He was already peeved at her. His words on the beach repeated in her mind.
"I'm not going to risk deliverance or the hive just to save our sorry asses. We're on our own out here, and the sooner you start accepting that, the safer humanity is going to be."
The otherworldly calls of the birds X had called vultures brought her back to reality. She decided to embrace their solo adventure and give X the benefit of the doubt.
"I really think we should keep an open channel to Timothy," she said as they walked.
"So he can annoy us? I don't think so."
"But he's just trying to help."
He stopped and walked back toward her.
"I don't trust robots, okay?"
Thunder boomed over the mountain, and Magnolia glimpsed several vultures flying out of the jungle canopy. Most of them had vanished sometime during the night when she was sheltered in the boat with X. Apparently not that concerned about the giant birds, he jumped over the twisted guardrail along the road. He helped Miles over and moved to the edge of a jungle. A bandolier of grenades hung across his chest armor and over his back, and extra magazines were stuffed into his duty belt and the cargo pockets of his suit. He looked like a man going to war, which didn't ease Magnolia's mind. She sheathed the blade and unslung her rifle as she trotted to catch up.
"We'll have to cut through the jungle to get to that building," he said,
pointing at the hotel in the distance.
"You sure that's a good idea?"
She instantly regretted the words.
"You want to lead?" he asked. "Maybe you and Pepper know where we can find parts to the radio, or better yet, a new boat."
"Pretty sure we're not going to find a new boat up here," she whispered.
X continued into the jungle. At the base of the mountain, gangly trees with thick green bark formed a fence along the shore, like soldiers standing guard. It wasn't so much the spike-covered branches or the hourglass trunks that bothered her. These weren't the flesh-eating trees she had fought in Florida. This bark didn't glow, and the vines didn't try to swallow them whole. This was just an old-fashioned jungle. What bothered her was knowing how much Roger would have enjoyed seeing this place. She could picture him stumbling down the path, gaping in awe at trees that somehow adapted to an environment without sunlight. She set off after X. Beetles the size of her boots scuttled across the path, and 2-headed lizards perched on rocks along the path. A mammal that looked like an oversized rat crunched through the undergrowth, blinking its saucer eyes at Magnolia before disappearing back into the jungle. Everything on this island had adapted, either to see in the darkness or to get by with no vision at all. Radiation levels here were mild, but that didn't mean they had always been. Each creature had evolved to survive here.
Even the fish and birds seemed to have undergone transformations. Some hadn't changed much, but the changes always made them better predators. The shark and the octopus had grown to gigantic proportions, as had the monstrous vultures. As they moved along the trail toward the eastern edge of the city, several structures rose over the dark canopy. Houses built onto the bluffs had their foundations and rooftops largely intact. She tried to picture a time when people had lived in places such as this, places once called paradise. But try as she might, she couldn't imagine what the old world was really like before the nuclear fires and the monsters.
"You okay back there, Mags?"
X whispered over the comm channel.
"Yeah, how's the arm?"
"Just another scratch."
He ducked a low branch, and Miles turned to her as if to say, "Hurry up." Even the dog seemed impatient with her today. A clicking sound on the trail made Magnolia whirl. The source was a purple beetle on the center of the path. It opened mandibles, exposing a row of teeth that looked sharper than necessary for a beetle, clicked again, and then scuttled away into foliage. Raindrops pattered on the canopy above. The sound was calming, and even the sporadic thunder and lightning had a soothing effect. Still, the dangers of the mutant paradise weighed heavily on her. The journey to the Metal Islands hadn't exactly started off well, and being stranded on unknown shores didn't help. On a section of trail unprotected by the tropical canopy, the dirt had turned to mud. She followed the tracks of X's big boots. The trail rose to a bluff, giving her another view of the ocean. X had stopped at the top, crouched low with Miles by his side. Magnolia took a sip of water from the straw in her helmet and looked out over the dark ocean. To the west, where the sea wolf lay beached, the tide was starting to recede.
"Come on,"
X said, waving her onward. Miles followed without complaint, but Magnolia finally raised her hand.
"Hold on," she said. "I don't like the idea of going farther without a plan."
X halted, and instead of replying, angled his rifle toward the mountains at a slope covered with thick undergrowth. At first, she thought he was pointing at the vultures flying above the canopy. She ducked when she saw them, but X remained standing. Miles, too, stayed on his feet. Only then did she realize that he wasn't pointing at the birds at all. Sheathing her sickle, she raised her carbine, zooming the scope in on a mushroom-shaped structure in the middle of the vast jungle.
"What in the..."
"Satellite dish," X said. "I saw it on the way in. That's where we're headed."
Magnolia lowered her rifle.
"I thought we were headed to the hotel. Why didn't you tell me this?"
"Because I figured you'd complain when you saw vultures up there. But I didn't want to just leave you at the boat, either."
"Listen, X," she said, frustration rising in her voice. "I know you may have a hard time believing it, but I've grown a lot since '80s. I'm not a little girl anymore."
"You never were a little girl."
Magnolia tilted her head, waiting for the rest.
"I've always known you had it in you to be a good hell diver. You're a damn fine one. But you need to trust me and stop rushing to do everything. That's always been your problem."
He paused.
"Your attitude doesn't help either."
"So I'm the one with an attitude."
"Yeah, I know what you're thinking," X said, "but save it for later and keep moving. We've got a long hike ahead."
He turned and continued up the trail, rifle cradled across his chest. A vulture wailed in the distance. This time, Magnolia didn't lag behind. She hurried to catch up with X, keeping quiet and trying to trust that he wasn't leading them into a nest of monsters. 5. X stood like a statue in the darkness, searching the belt of jungle in the green hue of his night vision. A camouflaged lizard perched on a rock ahead. He saw it only when it blinked reptilian eyes that apparently could see him just fine in the dark. All three of them were tracking a bug. A long tongue flicked out, and the lizard's face split down the middle, like a cracked egg, to swallow the insect. The head sealed shut, and the lizard skittered away. X continued looking for the real hostiles he was worried about. The vultures. Though he didn't hear them, he knew they were out there.
"Patience first," he reminded himself. "Always patience first."
Years of trekking across the ruined wasteland had taught him that.
There was a reason people back on the airships had called him the Immortal, and it wasn't because he had some magical immunity to death. He had survived through patience and strength, and more than once, pure blind luck. X didn't know how Magnolia, on the other hand, was still alive. She was always rushing missions. Speed and agility were useful, but they weren't everything, especially when the monsters were faster. It seemed she survived on blind luck all the time. She tapped her foot as he continued to scan and listen to the jungle. Before the journey, he had updated the microphones built into his helmet. Now he could pick up specific sounds in noisy places such as this place. He filtered through the racket of bugs, thunder, and rain, and even Magnolia's tapping foot, to pick up sounds of movement from the ground and sky. A faint rustle in the undergrowth, the soft whoosh of wings above. The microphones didn't make his hearing as acute as Miles's, but X certainly had an advantage that he never had back in the cold wastes, although he was having second thoughts about the enhanced audio now, given how much Pepper and Magnolia talked. At least he didn't have to deal with the AI right now. Looking up, he checked to see whether any of the vultures had left their nests. He had to take a step back for a view through the canopy. His boots sank into the mud. Arching limbs reached far into the sky. If he could only climb them, he would have a great view of the area, but the sharp thorns on the bark made climbing nearly impossible. And did he really want to risk falling? "Want me to scope things out?" Magnolia whispered over the comm channel. "No, stay put." After another few minutes of waiting and hearing nothing, he decided to move. He flipped off the safety on his rifle. He had a fresh magazine loaded and a grenade in the launch chamber. Using a hand signal, he motioned for Magnolia and Miles to follow him deeper into the jungle. Red mushrooms with a purple glow lined the path. The largest suddenly pulsed like a heart and sprayed green fluid into the air, a defense mechanism, he supposed, and probably poisonous. Reaching up to make sure his helmet was secure, he maneuvered around the mushrooms and pointed them out to Magnolia and Miles before moving ahead. A snake, as long as his leg, slithered across the dirt. X halted when he saw that the creature had two heads, one where it was supposed to be, and the other where the tail should be. "Gross," Magnolia whispered, jumping back. Miles let out a low growl, and X held up a hand to silence him. The farther they trekked, the more X wondered what else was hiding in this deformed jungle. He kept pushing on, alert but undeterred by external threats. He could deal with whatever lurked out here. The trail curved up a hill, giving him a look at the mountain above. Storm clouds drifted over the jagged peaks, dumping more rain on the island. The temperature dropped as they climbed higher. The cold rain hit the canopy, and a stream carved its way down the muddy trail. Slinging his rifle, he grabbed the tree to his right, then planted his boots, found purchase, and climbed around the slick spot. He turned to help Magnolia, but Miles moved with ease, bounding up the hill to stand beside him. The three continued toward the summit, where the jungle thinned, and the first sign of civilization gradually emerged. It was hard to see the building at first. Thick undergrowth surrounded the concrete rubble of the structure, and vines clung to the foundation. Half the building had collapsed over the centuries, but the roof over the standing section was still intact. To the right, tucked between two trees, was the satellite dish X had seen from the beach. The metal dish, angled southward, was draped with vines. Magnolia took up position beside him, and Miles sat on his haunches, looking, listening, smelling. Behind the dish and building, X spotted movement. Magnolia saw it too, and pointed at the birds perched on the branches. They counted 30 of the flying monsters. High on the branches, under an awning of pale banana leaves, there were twisted vines and thin branches which formed the bole of what looked like a nest. "Babies," Magnolia said. X zoomed in on the vulture nestlings. Even those were the size of a human child. Bald red skulls bobbed up in the nests, their yellow beaks clanking with hunger. As he watched, a full-grown vulture descended on the nest, something large and squirming gripped in its talons. These vultures were both hunters and scavengers. Another change brought on by mutations, and perhaps evolution. He considered using his grenade launcher to blow the little demons out of the nest,
but really didn't like the idea of going head-to-head with one. Nor did he like the idea of starting a fight that could draw more monsters to their position. No, the best way to get into the compound was to sneak in and not make any noise. He pulled back the charging handle of his rifle to chamber around, then tilted his helmet toward the building. Magnolia shook her head.
"Let me take Point X," she whispered over the comms. "I'm faster than you, especially right now."
He checked the birds again to make sure they couldn't hear the hushed conversation, but the perched creatures remained quiet. The only movement, a fist-sized blob of white shit that splattered on the ground.
"Remember that time in Hades when you didn't trust me? And..."
X cut Magnolia off.
"And you almost died? Yeah, I remember it perfectly. I don't want a repeat of that near disaster."
He really didn't want Magnolia pouting or complaining. A deep breath helped him dial back his frustration.
"Patience first. Always patience first."
"I know. So does that mean I can check this building out or not?"
X thought on it another moment, checked the vultures again, and nodded. Magnolia moved out of the tree line where the rain beat down on her. She sprinted in a low hunch across the field. Miles took her place, and X put a hand on him to calm him. X wasn't the only one slowing with age. Miles was 10 now, and even with his genetic modifications, he didn't move the way he used to. X raised his rifle at the trees, keeping the birds in his sights. Their long beaks were down against their feathery chests, their eyes closed. The nearly constant flash of lightning overhead was messing with his night vision, and he switched it off with a bump to his chin pad. The entire sky was illuminated by the storm, spreading weak blue light over the terrain. He checked the baby vultures with his scope, confirmed that they hadn't seen Magnolia, and then moved his scope back to her. She was almost across the field. Hopping over a patch of red mushrooms, she made a run for the building. When she reached the foundation, she hugged the wall and crept toward the door. As X watched, the noise-reducing microphones picked up a mushing sound. Miles must have heard or sensed something, too. He suddenly stood up, back rigid. X moved his scope back to the trees, scanning the branches for movement. But the vultures were still sleeping, and their babies weren't moving. The mushing sound came again, like boots hitting mud.
"What do you see, Miles?" X whispered.
The dog was looking toward Magnolia and growling softly. She grabbed the handle of the closed metal door, then hesitated, turning to her right. As she reached for the curved blade at her back, something slammed into her, knocking her to the ground in front of the building. X stood, holding in a shout. He trained his rifle on the area where something had tossed Magnolia across the dirt like a rag doll.
"Mags!"
he yelled. The birds in the trees burst into flight, their great wings kicking up a draft fierce enough to rustle the leaves on branches far below them. They screeched in alarm as they crossed the skyline. But it wasn't X's shout that set them off. The grunt of the thing that had Magnolia pinned to the ground came over the speakers in his helmet, and he flipped on his night vision goggles to finally see the abomination. The lizard that could split its head in two wasn't the only camouflaged creature out here. But this was no lizard. It was a hog-like beast covered in thick brown fur the color of the terrain. Miles growled at the mutant, apocalyptic version of the pigs on the hive. Covered in thick fur with a spiky mane, it was 4 times Miles' size, and it had Magnolia pinned to the ground. Tusks, upper and lower, protruded from a long jaw, dripping saliva onto her visor.
"X!" she shouted, flailing, writhing to get free. "Hold on, kid."
He was still trying to get a shot, but she was in the way, and the thought of hitting her made him hesitate. He flipped the selector switch to semi-automatic, and a second later, the beast's jaw moved into view. He squeezed off a shot that shattered an upper tusk. He pulled the trigger again, and an eyeball exploded. The beast leaped off, squealing in agony, and looked at X with its remaining eye. He kept the creature in his sights just in case it decided to make a run for him, but instead it turned and bounded into the foliage. The birds screeched overhead, circling and watching from a safe distance. By the time the beast vanished into the jungle, X was running. Miles chased him through the thick weeds and around the patches of mushrooms. Magnolia lay in the dirt about 20 feet from the building. She reached up for her helmet,
and X grabbed her by the arm and helped her to her feet.
"Can you run?"
he asked. A distant snort came in reply. Then three more, from different locations. This beast had friends.
"Move!"
X shouted,